Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 16th, 2003. Today's session is entitled The Laws of Geology. Disregard them at your peril. Session 2 of Basic Geology, Geology of the Holden Area and the Holden Mine, presented by Don Coberly, number COD 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Room. I'm Don Coberly. This is session 2 of the geology sessions. This is called The Laws of Geology, Disregard Them at Your Peril. And the point of the way to get started with this is let's do another one of those thought experiments that we did yesterday. It's one of those make-believe things. And let's assume for a minute that your task is to figure out the geology of an unknown area. For you guys, we can consider Railroad Creek Valley to be that unknown area. The first thing that we would do, and this is sort of priming the pump for the hike tomorrow, because we'll go through this again, and this is the MO we'll use tomorrow. The first thing we do is we get a base map. The USGS makes topographic maps of pretty much the whole United States that show where you are and what the elevation is. Is there anybody that isn't familiar, at least generally, with those? You need to know where you are. The second thing we would do, which we'll do tomorrow, is hike around, look at the rocks, and put the rock outcrops on the map. A rock outcrop is a rock unit or mass that you believe is attached to the rest of the world. There's rocks out here laying in the street, and we can look at those, and we can investigate those, and we can write down anything we want about them. They don't really tell us a lot because we don't know where they came from. It's got to be attached to something so that next year when we come back, we know it's in reasonably the same place. The third thing we would do would be to figure out the relationship in space of the rock units. We've got all the dots on the map, and we need a way to connect the dots that makes some sense. If all the rocks here were completely flat-lying, and we had 100 feet of whatever some kind of rock is, we'd go there and it's the same stuff, and we'd go on the other side of the creek and it's the same stuff, and we go behind us and it's right, and who cares? If you go to the Grand Canyon, all the upper layers there are all flat lines, so on both sides of the canyon at the same elevation, it's the same rock type, right? Layer cake geology is what we call it in geology talk, but that's not the case here. So that's the next thing we have to do. From those hypotheses that we make, we finish drawing on our map, and then we describe the geologic history of the area. What we're going to talk about today, the laws of geology, are the things that allow us to figure out the relationships of the rock units in space. This step right here. Another way, if you like the analogy yesterday that rocks are sort of words, these are the rules of grammar that help us put the words together so we can make something comprehensible out of them. Otherwise, they're just single words. If you don't like that analogy, I'll come up with something else next time. And then down in some cases, down here at the bottom is where you get paid, so that's a good thing. In what I think your use of this stuff that we're talking about might be, what we're going to talk about today helps you as you pick your Roadside Geology of Colorado book up and go for a ride from Cripple Creek to Leadville. You'll drive along and you'll see units and you'll look at them and you may jump out of the car. It will help you place those into some larger order. So that's the point, and that's what we're going to talk about today. I want to talk about these really quickly and then go into them more in detail with some handouts and some overheads. When I turn the screen down, we'll lose this, but I've got the two main things up on these speakers that I'm currently using as bulletin boards, so we'll be able to keep track of them that way. And this should stay up for a while if you want to write these things down. These, you can do a whole lot of geology with those, whatever they are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the one principle and the five rules, or four rules, four laws. Again, going through the idea from yesterday that geology is a pretty logical science, a pretty common sense science. The principle or the law itself I've written in blue. The distillation of it or somebody else's is written in red, and then the questions that come up from that I've written down in green here. So the first principle that we want to talk about is the principle of uniformitarianism. And this is the founding principle of the science of geology, derived by James Hutton, who was the father of modern geology, and his point was simply the present is the key to the past. The things that we see now have occurred through history. Geology 100 million years ago wasn't a whole lot different than it is now, or a billion years ago. Now, it falls apart when you get to the really early Earth history. Some of the rules don't necessarily apply, but we still got, if you consider the Earth to be 4.6 billion years old, this stuff's been going on for at least the last 3.5 billion. We got plenty of time to work, you know. And the stuff before that, we don't know very much about anyway. The second is the law of original horizontality, which has got to be something somebody wrote for a master's thesis. Stuff gets laid down flat is the simplification of that. Rock units were generally laid down flat. Gravity essentially argues for that. Sedimentary rocks being shed out into still water get laid down flat, or nearly so. The thing that comes out of that, and that by itself to me isn't necessarily revealing, earth-shaking I was going to say, but that's a bad if it isn't flat now, how did it get unflat? Right? If all we had was the law of original horizontality, we'd have layer cake geology everywhere on the planet, and that'd be the end of it, and geology curriculum would be about a day long, and then we'd graduate. So if we go and we see rocks and they're not just laid down flat, we got to come up with some reason of how did they get the way they are now, because they didn't get laid down. If you see rocks stood up on end, they didn't get stood up on end. So we have to come up with some mechanism to have gotten them there from their original flat position, or essentially flat position. The third is the law of superposition. The distillation of that is the old stuff is on the bottom. If you lay down a layer of sediment, and then you lay down another layer of sediment on top of it, and you lay down another layer of sediment on top of it, the old stuff's on the bottom, right? The oldest dated material is the lowest layer. You can't lay an older unit and then sneak a younger unit in underneath it. That's kind of hard to do. In some cases, you can do it with igneous rock, but we'll keep that in mind as we're talking more through this. So that when you see a layer of rocks, if you drill through a layer of rocks, you assume that the oldest unit is on the bottom. The question that we need to consider about that then is which way is up? If you take oldest to youngest and you turn the whole mess upside down, you no longer have that relationship. And we'll talk more about that. Just keep that sort of ponder in your mind for right now. We'll talk about it more in a minute. The next thing is the law of inclusions. We'll talk about bake zones and chilled margins. We touched on it real briefly yesterday about how the crystals might get smaller as you go towards the edge of a big rock, a big intrusive mass that was coming up. The last thing we'll talk about amongst the laws is the law of cross-cutting relationships. We'll probably finish with this idea. There's a geologic term for a geologic condition called an unconformity, and it's a really... if you do a lot of geology, it's an important thing to think about. And it's important if you're doing geologic mapping, you come across these unconformities in which is a break, you have some sedimentation, then it stops for a while. And then it starts up again or something else happens. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. So that's what we're going to cover today. I have a set of handouts for everybody that is fairly thick, 15 or 20 pages. Feel free to take this with you if you want. If you leave it behind, I won't feel bad at all. There are what I think are in here are some fairly useful things to look at and a few things to have just on, again, these basic laws. So that if you get serious about doing this and want to do it somewhere, you'll have this sort of little stash of tricks and hints to go along and take to the field with you and see how they might apply to the specifics of where you're going. And I got more if anybody does anybody, I know there's someone up in the balcony who's too bashful to ask for one. I usually, whenever I have a chance at an overhead projector and start a geologic talk, I start it with this slide, which you don't have in your packet, which is a sign from the First Baptist Church in suburban Joplin, Missouri, Carl Junction, Missouri, that says, "It is better to know the Rock of Ages than the Age of Rocks." So it's sort of a tie between the other things that are going on here in sessions and this, and the thing is, the people there in Carl Junction, Missouri take that very seriously there. At the end of the session yesterday, somebody came up and talked to me and posed a question that led into a sort of the chemistry of rocks. And a couple of years ago, I was doing some volunteer teaching here and came up with this analogy for the elements that we find in crustal rocks. These are the rocks that we can essentially get to. If we were taking the Earth as a whole, we would find a lot more iron and nickel because we think that's what the core of the Earth is, and the outer mantle is made up of iron and nickel. We don't know that for sure, but we think we know it. But the rocks that we can get to, that we can get our hands on, these are the elements that make up those rocks. Oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, sodium, potassium, and magnesium. If you add up those eight, it makes up 98.4% of everything. So you don't need to know a lot of chemistry to know some basic geology. You just need to know those eight things. Quartz, the most common rock that everybody's probably heard of, is SiO2. There's so much of it because that's what's here. The other rock-forming minerals, plagioclase, which some of you, or feldspar that people might have heard of, is potassium and aluminum along with silicon and oxygen. The other primary rock-forming minerals are simply those eight things mixed up in different ways. What this shows you, and I think I say at the bottom, listed elements are the only ones certain to be in the 1,000-piece kit. I think of this as a Lego kit with different colors for each of these. And you want to make a mineral, and so you put this stuff together in a certain way. This is all you get in a 1,000-piece kit. So in 1,000 pieces of the planet or 1,000 pieces of the crust, this is all that's going to be there. There won't be any copper there. There won't be any gold there. To get that, you got to buy the 10,000-piece set. So that's if you can know 98.4% of geology, chemistry, in remembering eight elements. It's the rest of it that sort of makes it interesting. Go ahead.
It's really surprising carbon isn't in there, isn't it? I mean, we think of our world as a biological world, but carbon must be in the 10,000 piece.
Carbon is just about at the bottom of it. It would be about the next on the list. So calcium carbonate limestone is, yeah, but in the grand scheme of things, there's way more rock than there is stuff, living stuff. All right. The law of the principle of uniformitarianism. The present is the key to the past. Your packet of handouts has a Xerox of this. On one side, we have a fossil. I don't want to say it's a fossil, but it's like a fossil. Mud or imprints in a rock that's found to be 3.5 billion years old. And on the other side, we have a bubbling mud pot that somebody shot a photo of 5 years ago in Bolivia. Or someone could have taken this picture at Yellowstone last year. The assumption is we see this today. This looks just like this. Sometime 3.5 million years ago, there was a place like Yellowstone. This doesn't come from some alternative source. This comes from the same thing that we can see today.
3.5 million or billion?
3.5 billion, excuse me. The same way that when we go to the beach, we see what the stuff, the material looks like on the beach, and we put it in a jar. We make the analogy back to whenever that beach occurred in eastern Wyoming, where the sand was in the jars that I picked up yesterday. We make the assumption that the same processes that we see today, volcanoes blowing up, glaciers doing what glaciers do, mountains being built over time, floods happening, those processes have gone on through geologic time. And those are the things that are responsible for what we see. We don't need to invoke stuff that you know, gravity has always been down. We don't have to assume that at some point in the past gravity was up, or that there were other forces at work. Now again, to be precise, or to be a stickler, there was a period in the early Earth history where I don't think this necessarily applied, but we don't have very much evidence of the first maybe billion years of the planet's existence. So at least for the last 3.5 billion, we can say that this principle has applied. Go ahead.
Well, when did they pass the law of gravity?
Sorry? If it needed to be passed, it might not have made it. is kind of what I'm thinking. So, we don't need to, the rates of the processes, this doesn't imply that there are the same and as many glaciers present on the planet as there are, have always been through time. There have been times when there have been more, and there have been times when they've been less, but they act about the same way as we see them today. So we don't have to come up with new and weird ways to get stuff to happen. We just need to look around and figure out how we get the mud rings. Well, let's go around and find the hot pot, and now we know. So that's the principle of uniformitarianism. The law of original horizontality, I don't have any slides for because it's so simple. Stuff gets laid down flat. And then the stickler detail for that is, or nearly so. If you come up the Columbia River Gorge from Portland to here, a lot of that stuff is flat lying, and then you get to the end and it tips a little bit. Well, it ain't all bloody level flat, but it's pretty close. And if you look at the units on the side of a volcano, they're kind of a little bit steeper. But 99% of the time, the rule holds, so that, again, that thing by itself doesn't mean very much, but what it means is when we see stuff stood up on end or at some orientation, we need to get it there somehow other than it having been laid down that way. There's the, what's the soil mechanics property of, you can't stack sand up to a 90 degree slope, right? There's a certain angle of repose. You try to stack it up more than that and it all slides down. So you don't stack stuff up on end. It just doesn't work. So that's the law of horizontality. The law of superposition, oldest stuff is on the bottom, yet it gets younger as you get towards the top. Right? That's the common sense sort of thing. I gave this example of turning everything up on end, and somebody in the audience should reasonably think, well, geez, now you're talking. Yesterday we talked about all of this stuff being common sense. Tell me how it is, or how common can this be that rock units that get laid down flat get to be tipped so much that they're more than 90 degrees. What I'm suggesting is rock units, something like this happens. Right here you've got a number of rock units, and for some reason they get bent so hard, if you bend them a little bit, you bend them like this, right? You bend them a little bit, if you're pushing from this way, pushing on a rug, say, you bend them up a little bit. If something happens to bend them up a lot, now you bend them up almost on end, and now we're in the third scenario. This is 1, 2, and 3. Now you bend them all the way around. Come on, Don, get over it. you know, how far do we have to go to see where this happens? Well, up past the Portal Museum. The Holden ore body is contained in an area that has been overturned. So this is a fairly common geologic occurrence. Somebody in the introduction had said they had spent some time in the Alps or had taken an elder hostel in the Alps. Here is a drawn cross-section through some of the rocks in the Alps, and if you follow, you don't have this in your handout, if you follow this unit right here that's a little bit distinctive, you can see here's a point where those rocks have been overturned more than 90 degrees, right? They come up in an angle here that's less than 90 degrees and then they get overturned. So this would be a place where we're, you know, we're walking along going law of superposition, oldest on top, youngest on top, oldest on the bottom, and all of a sudden it goes apart on us. That's how that happens. And this is particularly in mountainous areas like Holden or the Alps, this happens a lot. So it's something that we need to be aware of. So the next sheet that you have in your packet, I'm hoping, wait a minute, did we jump over a color picture?
Yeah.
Golly. The law of superposition. Oldest on the bottom, youngest on the top. You have a color photo there that is a non-geologic simulation of a potential geologic occurrence. How about that? It's you put a candle on a plate and you burn it, and then you put another color candle on top and you burn it, and you put a third one on top and you burn it. And now, instead of thinking of these as being melted candle wax, you think of them as being lava flows coming out of a volcano in Hawaii. And if you go to Hawaii or some other place and you find a volcanic flow that has some kind of identifying feature, like a color, or for some reason it had more bubbles in it when it came out, and so it's got a distinctive texture to it, and you can follow it and trace it, you find someplace that another lava flow is on top of it. How did it get there? It's a younger lava flow. Or else somehow the first one snaked underneath it, and that just doesn't happen very much. So this is the second version of the candle melting plate that I've put together, and I still don't like it, so I'm going to go home and burn some more candles. But the way I look at this is that darkest candle, either the blue or the black one, was probably the first one burned, right? In right below the red candle that's still sitting there, so there's a little clue right there. I mean, take advantage of all the clues you've got. I might have, you know, burned the yellow one last and then put the red one back in there to fool you, but that's next year's class. So we see just below where the red candle is sitting, there's the yellow candle wax melted on top of the black. But there's only two ways that could happen. Yellow after black on top of black, or yellow with some space underneath it with black coming out underneath it, and favor the simplest explanation first. And then there are places the red is lying on top of both the yellow and the black, and therefore we will make the guess that the red is the youngest, right? Is there anything? So I'm trying to make some comment here about how geology is pretty common sense, and just to make the point again, it's no different melting candle wax on a plate and figuring out which one came first, then doing, in particular, lava flows. Youngest stuff's on top.
Thank you.
All right. The next handout that you have is from a scientific technical geologic document saying criteria for determining top and bottom of beds. If we can determine the top of the bed in any sequence, our problem is solved. You got to have the top of the bed has to be the youngest part of the bed, right? You lay down the bottom part of the bed before you get to the top. So if we can determine where the top is, now we know which way is up. And we don't need to worry about our law of superposition holds. We know we've identified the top of the bed, therefore everything beneath it falls in place. So this idea that we used from the Alps picture of being able to follow a particular bed, or in doing geology in the real world, when we go out tomorrow, we'll find a rock unit. If you can trace that rock unit through time or through space and you put it on your map, you can follow that and do the same by seeing at some point if it falls all the way around like the Holden ore body does, and now it's gone back on top of you, you know those beds are overturned. The second way to look at another technique, this is sort of a pick list of things to think about as you're out doing geology in the field. One of these may apply to the situation that you're trying to figure out. The second one talks about scouring or channeling. And so if you have a flat lying bed, that then has a stream or a creek run across it, you're going to have a stream bed or a stream channel cut into it. So if you have a series of flat-lying beds, all of a sudden you have a little gouge in one, and particularly if it's filled in with sediment, your guess is going to be that this way is up, and that what happened was there was a little creek there that got filled in. The only other alternative you can come up with, and you can think about this in the field, turn it upside down and see how it looks. And now, instead of having little gouges with stuff in them, we've got little humps. Now, our idea yesterday of the world as the environment as a rock tumbler, what the environment is trying to do is wear the whole planet down flat. The higher you push mountains up, the more they get eroded. What the world's trying to do is get to a flat sphere. The world, in general, doesn't like these little lumps. It's going to do what it can to get rid of them. So, if the two, again, you got two hypotheses here. One is it's a channel filled in with stuff, and the other is it's a bump that somehow got left and covered over with more stuff. It's more likely the first than the second. And go with the simplest proposition first. There are a number of other techniques that we can use. This next one says if you have a bed in place and something comes and flows over it, it may pick up and collect pieces of the underlying material. Right? We have an example of that from yesterday that I'll show again in just a second. And again, the other way to think about this is to flip it upside down. But somehow we had a bed lying there, and then we have some fragments of the stuff that's on top of it. And how do you get, here was a bed laying here minding its own business, you got something that comes in on top of it and somehow drops some pieces of itself out. Again, that's a less likely scenario. So if you find something like that in the real world.
Is that like glaciers with rocks? Glacier recedes and it drops rocks.
That's one place that happens. And knowing that you're here and knowing that you're in a glacial valley, you might anticipate seeing that. But that material, what's above that? What the glacier is not still there. If for the phony scenario, the scenario we don't like to have occurred, you would have to have some rock unit above it that looked like the little stuff that got dropped behind. What I'm saying is, this doesn't happen in reality. I don't ever see this, but it's, so you have your two choices anyway. They're the only two. If you run across this set of things in the field, there's only two ways it could have happened. One of them makes sense and one of them doesn't. Get rid of the one that doesn't, and now it helps you believe that this stack of units that you see in the field is face up. That's the way it should be. There are a number of others just another part of the laundry list to look at. Here is a situation where we have what looked to be, to some degree, a flat-lying bed. We have a cut in it, and we have the cut filled in with some other material. That's the about second idea that we talked about. So either this is some original surface that's been cut into, and then that stream or whatever was in here flooded out and silted out and moved to some other place. The other scenario is the whole thing's upside down. Now you have this long-standing hump of material that's there for no, you know, it's in a big old anthill or something, and now all this other stuff filled in around it. This is much the simpler explanation and the one that we think we know to be true. This is in Florida. This is, in fact, old coral bed material that was then eroded and something was deposited in there. So I think that's my only Florida geology slide. More just other things to look at as you're out in the field and you're wondering about this. You can read through these at your leisure if you care any further about it. If you go to the beach, here's another one. The present is the key to the past. If you go to the beach or the tide pools and you see an area where the ocean comes in or goes out, you see ripple marks in the bed, right? Those ripple marks are sort of concave up. And so if you see and if you do geology long enough, you will see rock units where you will see precisely that. Your conclusion from the principle of uniformitarianism is that was at some point an environment similar to the one you see at the beach. So you put that in, you write down in your little, either mentally or in your notebook, to say, came across unit ripple marks, therefore at some point was maybe beach or maybe creek, but it was clearly laid down by water. The other thing we utilize that in another way to say, this is right side up, right? The other alternative is that we have these kind of lumps, scallops. Again, if you when little scallops form, when scallops form on the planet, what the planet wants to do is wash them away. So this is the more likely scenario. All right, that's which way is up. And I think maybe here is that slide of the rock that I showed you yesterday from Indonesia. If we wanted to use our technique, well, let's hold off on that for just a second. We'll get back to it. The law of inclusions. The law of inclusions states something really simple that you probably can think of. If you have a rock unit and you have a rock unit that is cut by a material, in this case a dike, which is material that has been injected, and within that stuff that's been injected you have an inclusion, a piece of the country rock, a piece of the rock on both sides that's included within the dike, your conclusion is that the included stuff is the older stuff. And I'll explain that a little bit more in just a minute. This is a geology logbook, field notebook from an aspiring young geologist in the spring of 1981 in the Inyo Mountains of Southern California. I know about this a little bit because that guy was me. And I was doing my field mapping and we came across a spot where this was very clearly laid out for us. And here is my notebook. Here's my drawing. So clearly I could benefit from some time with Kristen, because if any of you can make heads or tails out of this, I drew it, and it's hard for me to read. This was a big cut, a big trench that we had dug into the side of a rock. And the rock had weathered enough that we were able to do that. And we have dike of KG. We had two different units, one that we called KG and one that we called KQM, I think. And the K represents the time period it's from, and the G represents either a granite for G. The QM is just another kind of rock that's sort of like that. So I tried to draw this out. We have a bunch, we have this big mass of rock that has another tabular slice. The two, what I think has happened is the two parts were forced apart by some material that got injected within it. Dike of KG cuts through the main body of KQM. A chill zone is present in the dike. The dike is the thin slice of stuff that I think got injected in. Now, if we think about what we talked about yesterday, that hot material that got injected in some places is in contact with the cold, relatively cold, rock that's already there. And so that's the stuff that solidifies very rapidly and doesn't crystallize very much. And as you go in towards the middle of the dike, what a piece of dike in the middle of the dike has next to it is more hot dike. And so it cools more slowly, the crystals get bigger. So this is a very common thing that you'll see is what's called a chill zone. As you get towards the edges of something that's been injected, the crystals get smaller because just from what we talked about yesterday. A baked zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. The same way that this hot rock gets cooled faster, the country rock gets heated along those places where the new rock has come in, and essentially a little bit of it recrystallizes so that you see bigger crystals on the outside, on the faces of the original material. Recrystallization seems to make the parent rock darker. A xenolith of the KQM is present. The xenolith is the piece of rock that gets included. So you had a stack of rock sitting there minding its own business. There was a fracture in it. Some hot rock came into it, did the same thing that the Indonesian rock did, and ripped a piece of the parent rock out as it was being emplaced. And now you find that hunk of the parent rock in the new stuff. That xenolith, that included rock, has to be older material. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
So if you find that in the field, and I tried to scrounge around in the Portal Museum to come up with a piece that I thought was good to represent that, I didn't find anything up there. But again, we have our Indonesian rock that show, now, here we have the mass of the rock and we have a bunch of inclusions. In this case, they were ripped up. Which is, if we took all those older rocks and compared it to the matrix, the stuff that came down, which of those is older? The inclusions are, right? They had to have been in place first, laying on the ground, so that this thing could come screaming down the side of the volcano and pick them up and incorporate them. The incorporated stuff is the older stuff. Has to be. The only other explanation is this: that ash layer was there in some sort of malleable form, and something came and punched all these rocks in it. If you ever see anything like that on the planet, let me know, because we got a scoop. So, when you come across a rock like this, where you have inclusions in a larger rock, those inclusions are the older rock. So that if we then wanted to do a geologic map of that area, I'll be done in less than a minute. If we wanted to do a geologic map of that area, if we wanted to put things in a relative sequence, we could, if we busted this apart enough to be able to find, say, 50 little pieces of rock, and we'd look at them and we'd say, oh, well, 15 of them are this red thing and 12 of them are this kind of black, bladey looking thing and whatever. We know each one of those rock types is older than this flow, and we can start to put in our mind, we can say, from oldest to youngest, we don't know whether the red rocks are older than the black rocks right now, we just know they're both older than the stuff. And I had to explain to him that that wasn't the relative dating I was talking about. What we're talking about with relative dating is taking a series of events and ordering them from oldest to youngest. And we talk about this being relative dating because we don't yet have any way, and we probably don't when we're in the field, of saying what is the precise age of each of these events. This thing happened 50 million years ago, this one happened 48 million years ago, this one happened 22 million years ago. Those determinations are way beyond what I can do in the field and what you can do in the field, and I think probably what you care about very much. But we can, through the law of cross-cutting relationships, say which are the older things and which are the younger things. And one of the examples that can you see that? I'll use the overhead. Okay. This is harder than it looks, just so you know. Unless you were a school teacher. We have, and again, this is taken from a basic geology sort of workbook. And the thing is, it starts out really simple and then gets more complicated. If we think about, rather than paper and tape and artwork, the geology world, if we have a bed that gets, first off, let's try to push this thing back to where all the beds get laid down flat. We have a layer of sand that gets laid down offshore. For some reason, things change, and now we lay down some silt on top of it. Things change, mountains get built up. The amount of energy that the streams produce increases as the mountains get higher, therefore we can move bigger particles because you all had fluid mechanics. And now we deposit sand back on top of it. And then for some reason, since we're in California, a fault snaps and breaks all three layers. After that fault breaks the three layers, another realm of sedimentation occurs, and now we have the picture that we see here. And we can tell, because of the law of cross-cutting relationships, the order of events, the upper layer is not broken by the fault, therefore it's younger than the last time the fault has moved. All of the other layers were broken by the fault, so they were in place before the fault moved. We assume that bed 2 and bed 1 are older than bed 3 because of law of superposition. We're going to make a guess that everything that things are in the right order, or that the which way is up, up is the way it appears to be, and therefore we get older as we get deeper. So if we were writing our geologic history, number 5, describe geologic history of this block diagram. Unit 1 gets laid down, unit 2 gets laid down, unit 3 gets laid down, faulting occurs, unit 4 gets laid down. Right? Simple. Again, I do geology because I like to do puzzles. This is just doing puzzles, right? And as puzzles go, first off, we have one picture here that may show a fault right here that offsets this rock unit, and therefore our conclusion would be that the rock unit was laid down prior to the fault. At least this surface, right? I think what happens is that here we have a ledge that seems to jut a little bit as it gets broken by this, and now it's been offset, and therefore that ledge was formed, but whatever geologic event occurred to form that ledge was in place, and then it was broken by the fault. And this concept is used everywhere, having everything to do with geology. In the Portland, the Milwaukee folks here, this is suburban Portland. One of the issues is the Portland Hills Fault, which runs near downtown and has a bunch of people who built on top of it. When's the last time that thing, when's the last time there was a big earthquake on the Portland Hills Fault? It's the same issue as faults in downtown LA, only it's a little different because there's not quite so many people in Portland. There was a geologic event, the Missoula floods or the Bretts floods, between 15 and 13,000 years ago. Big floods came down the Columbia and deposited sediment back up the Willamette, which goes down towards Salem, Oregon, and created a bunch of lake layers. We found these, an old college worker, a guy that I worked with in college, who's now a professor. They took a big trench and they found these stream or these lake sediments, and they found that there have been two offsets of them. And so since those sediments are 15,000 years old, they've decided that they've seen two offsets, and therefore there have been two major earthquakes in the last 15,000 years in the Portland area on that fault. And the way they know that is by the law of cross-cutting relationships. And in that case, it's not a relative age date, it's an actual date, because they've used other methods to date those beds.
In last week's paper in Seattle, it tells about how they dug those trenches on Bainbridge Island. You know Bainbridge Island?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. On Bainbridge Island to trace the Seattle Fault, and it's different than they thought it was.
Okay. We had our easy diagram. Here we get to a situation where it's a little more complicated. We're building up slowly. In this case, we have a series of beds, bed one through bed seven, that have been laid down. They've been laid down horizontally because of the law of original horizontality. We have some event that tips them up on end, some probably mountain building event. For some reason, there is some compression that comes from this direction that pushes, and it's like pushing a rug. You push on a rug from two sides and it folds, right? One thing I forgot to tell you about or mention was, I've said geology is a common sense science. Somebody should have called me on the idea that, well, you know, Don, rock is kind of hard. How do you bend rock to the point where you got stuff overturned up on Honeymoon Heights? Well, a rock is a solid. Solid is defined as something that has a specific shape. But rock, like other things, glass, has a property called ductility, which means that if you push on it really slowly, you can deform it a little bit. If you push on it too hard, it'll break. If I try to push on this mirror real hard right now, it'll bust. Glass has some ductility to it. You think it's real hard, but if you go to England or Europe and see some of those windows that Mary Jo and Gloria told were put in the 1200, you got some 800-year-old windows. If you look at them in cross-section, they're skinnier at the top and they're wider at the bottom. That's because over the last 800 years, that glass is slowly working down under the effects of gravity. It's a really viscous fluid is a way to think of it. If you try to force it this fast, you get a bunch of glass pieces in your hand, but give it 800 years and now you got a droopy, fatter thing at the bottom, and it's skinnier at the top. Use that same principle over 50 or 100 million years or longer, and you can push on a rock unit and it will deform ductally, and now you can bend it enough to get it into a shape where you can overturn it. And that's what happens. So, I don't know if that's still so common sense, but the thing about geology is you've got time. You don't have to push on things very hard or very fast because you got 4.6 billion years to get stuff done. So, something happens. We build mountains over here. It tips these rocks up on end. The world does what it wants to do, and it shaves things off and makes them smooth again. So now, at some point in time, we have this set of rocks that are stood up on end that have been eroded flat. The situation changes from erosion to deposition. This is now back on the coast of California, and the mountains have been built. or actually the mountains that have pushed this up are still sand, are still here. Rain falls on the mountains and starts to bring rock units down, and they get deposited. This unit number 8 looks like they've shown that it has picked up some of the pieces of the underlying stuff, the stuff that was already there. And then you run, you lay down another rock or sediment layer on top of it, and the whole thing gets lithified. So we, again, through our law of cross-cutting relationships and law of original horizontality, we can order these events sequentially. We can't do anything yet about the real time that it happened in. And as you go on from here, there are, you can make it more complicated, and you can add little pieces of to your knowledge if you get real serious about doing this. When we look at a series of folded beds and we come across one where we don't see that fold anymore, the conclusion there is whatever the folding event was that warped these beds was finished before Unit 4 got laid down. Does that make sense? Otherwise, we'd see that deformation in Unit 4. So these are the conceptual things that we will take to the field with us tomorrow. The field trip isn't set up so perfectly that we will be able to see these things, but if you do some roadside geology somewhere, or if you take, is Ward here?
No.
If you take a geology hike, or if you take a hike somewhere where you're seeing the geology all the time and can put all this together, now you can use these skills, use these ideas, these concepts to date things relatively, oldest to youngest. And that's the, again, in our make-believe task that we've been given to learn the geology, that's the thing that we do. And as your packet goes on, it gets more complicated all the time. We have just another, this is the puzzle just gets a little bit more a little more complicated in a series of rocks that have been laid down flat, and then somehow one of these dikes that I mentioned to you seems to get shot up through it. We know it gets shot up through all four layers, 1, 2, 3, and 4, because it cuts them. It doesn't cut layer 5 as well. Some of that dike has been eroded off as layer 5 has gotten laid down and is included in layer 5. So if we're doing the geologic history of this area, unit 1 gets laid down, unit 2 gets laid down, unit 3 gets laid down, unit 4 gets laid down, dike happens, unit 5 gets laid down. Right? One more to look through. We have a situation where some units got laid down flat. All of the units have been laid down flat, and it looks to me like at least 2 different times rock has been intruded up into some part of the package. This would be sedimentary materials that had gotten laid down, and then for some reason some of the intrusive rock that we talked about yesterday came up and ate into it. And some, to me, that looks like later different event that they're trying to portray here happened as well. What do we notice? What can we guess? If we look at this, the side of the block diagram towards me, this intrusive rock only comes up through layer 3. So if that was the only side of the world that we could look at, we might mistake something. When we see it on the front side, it intrudes all the way up into unit 5, right? So we can say that Unit 5's an older event than the intrusion, because Unit 5 gets cut by the intrusion, right? Some portion of it does. I don't think we can, well, yeah, we can. We can say that the black line dike is a newer event than the speckled white intrusion, because the black line cuts the white stuff, right? And if you don't even know the law of cross-cutting relationships, you can use common sense to say, all right, that black thing was there, and then the white stuff came in all the way around it and didn't do anything to it. And that's a hard sell to me. I don't think that makes very much sense. nothing cuts Unit 6. So we don't know. You can say, well, Unit 6 doesn't get cut, it comes later. Not necessarily. It's simply that the Unit 6 may have happened prior to these. They don't cut it, so we can't say anything about the relationship of the two things. Either the white speckly stuff or the black, we don't know whether those happened and then Unit 6 was laid down, or whether Unit 6 was laid down and then these things happened. They just never got to it, right? It's a question that we still have. Go ahead.
In actuality, if you were digging down and find those layers, wouldn't you find little pieces of layers 1, 2, 3, and 4 kind of on top of that? Wouldn't some of it be still stuck up there?
Up here?
Uh-huh. Because that looks like it's so perfectly neatly cut out.
Well, if I think the pretend that the book is trying to get to here is that this stuff came in a molten state, and if it did that, it would be melting and including stuff as it comes up through it. I'm guessing that they're thinking this is going at some slow rate, so it's not like it wouldn't collect things up and push them ahead. It would
absorb
perfect word. So. And I think the next page, there are nothing written there to give us any clues. And this is the puzzles that if you want to spend some time doing over a cup of coffee later and come and talk to me about, or if you're having trouble sleeping, try to get into one of these and it'll put you up to sleep. But this is just making the simple things that we've talked about more complicated, and it's the same thing. If something cuts it, it's a younger event. In some instances, I suspect there's the trick in here that we just saw in the last one, that there'll be questions that we can't determine simply because something doesn't get cut by anything. And again, we use the technique all the time in the field to say older or younger. Nothing about what the specific ages of things are. The next three pages that you have in your handouts are precisely the same thing I've been talking about, presented by two other textbook writers. My experience is I find some things that I get explained to me one way and they don't make any sense at all, and somebody else explains it and it makes perfect sense. So it's just more stuff for you to look at if you're interested, and maybe one of the things seems complicated and then you hear it another way and it comes out really clearly. The last thing I want to talk about is this thing that I call an unconformity. And an unconformity, oh heck, I only had a geologic dictionary. Oh wait, I do. This will be a point in the tape that if I talk too long, they'll be able to cut out and save a little bit. Unconformity, a break or gap in the geologic record, such as an interruption in the normal sequence of deposition of sedimentary rocks, or a break between eroded metamorphic rocks and younger sedimentary strata. Okay, it's a break. In some of our simpler block diagrams, what we think I think what's implied in those is that the sedimentation was fairly constant. And we laid down a bed of sand because we had mountains up in the headlands behind us, and then we eroded those down, and so there wasn't so much elevation, so the water couldn't move so dense or so big a material, so now we lay down silt on top of it. And that sedimentation is constant through time. What happens if, for some reason, another set of mountains get built up, and instead, all the rivers go the other way? Now you have this stack of rocks, and now, as part of that mountain building episode, it gets pushed up into the environment, and now you're eroding that stuff down. Those mountains get worn down, and now another set comes up, and the rivers start coming this way again. that unconformity, that surface represents a break in time. One of the ways that we get an unconformity, and maybe I just talked about this, sediment is deposited. We have our series of stuff that gets laid down. A series of beds that get laid down. They get folded during the mountain building. They get eroded off, and more sediment gets deposited on top of it. So here we have this break. We see stuff beneath it. We trace that. We know what the relative age dates are. We have new flat line stuff on top, and we have this break in between the two. That break, that surface, may represent way more geologic time than everything else we can see. So the space may be, or the time may be in the space, rather than, so we see this stack of thousands of feet of rock that gets laid down over, say, 50 million years. Well, that's a long time. We age date that, and we find that it's 3 billion years old. We have a break, and now, and this is what happens at the Grand Canyon, right? You see all the flat-lying rock, and you see this break, and then you see tilted layers beneath it. And the majority of the time that you see there is in that infinitesimally thick surface, rather than in all the stack of the mile-thick stack of rocks. So it's an important thing in sort of conceptual geology to not get confused that, oh yeah, it's all this rock, it's all the laying down of stuff that took all the time. In some cases, that stuff got laid down and there was maybe a mile of stuff on top of it that then got eroded away. We'll never know, because it's gone. But we have that surface, and now we start the new set of sedimentation on top of it. And it was that unconformity. Here we have a picture. Unconformable contact of old red sandstone beds on vertical Silurian rocks at Sicker Point, Berwickshire, Scotland. It was from a study of this locality that James Hutton in 1788 first realized the meaning of unconformity. The geologist standing just above the contact. Here's a graduate student posing in Hutton gentleman farmer gear with his rock hammer looking down. This is the birthplace of modern geology. James Hutton, who was a gentleman farmer, had too much time on his hands, wandering around doing geology, looking at the rocks, came to this point, and of course at this point, 1788, there were two events in geologic history, creation and Noah's flood. That's it. World 6,000 years old, we know that because we've chased the Archbishop Usher, explained it through the lifespan of the people and the generations in the Bible. And Hutton, because he had too much time on it, he was on a walk that some Franciscans had suggested he go on. And instead of paying attention to the directions to just go out and be, he was looking at the geology and saw vertical rock, an unconformity, and tilted rock. And he said, wait a minute. And by the principle of uniformitarianism, which he was the first person to illuminate, wait a minute, I see the ocean every day and it's laying down these thin layers of rock, but it's laying them down really slowly. What's represented here? From the law of original horizontality, these things had to get laid down flat. So he traced back in his mind, all right, what's the set of events that had to occur to get this here? One, all of this stuff had to get laid down flat. That takes a while. Two, something had to happen to jimmy it up on end because it's darn near vertical. Three, there is some unknown period of time represented by the unconformity. Four, the beds get laid down, but they get laid down flat also. They're not flat anymore, so we had to have five, something to tip them up on end, and then six, something to push it up to where I could be standing on. And his take was 6,000 years probably wasn't enough time to do that. But this is the birthplace. This is Assisi for St. Francis folks, and Wrigley Field for Cubs fans, and I don't know, Augusta National for golfers, or Carnegie Hall for music lovers, or whatever. This is the place, and so that's why this moody geology grad student has his knickers on and has sent the photo home to mom. Not knickers, plus four, sorry. And maybe a few of you have this in your packet. Most of you probably don't, but this is just another color photo of that same thing. And so, again, Hutton was both revolutionary and commonsensical about the whole thing. It just, he saw things in a different light and used what, again, a bunch of common sense and a bunch of laws that we have now formalized so that you can get good grades on them, and came up with geology. And I have one last slide to show another place. This is that series of events that Hutton saw in Scotland occurs the planet over. This is Glenwood Springs, Colorado, right off I-70. You can pull off to the side of the road and see this road cut and take a picture just like I did. And again, once you see that, you can relatively order a number of events in your mind. Here we have a bunch of flat-lying rocks, or tilted rocks that originally had to be laid down flat. I don't think we have any idea, I don't know, whether these things were laid down flat and tipped up like this, or whether they were laid down flat and tipped all the way over on top of themselves. If we were there all together, we'd run across the road and we'd start looking through our AGI notes and trying to decide which way's up. So usually, make the simplest guess first. It's easier to get stuff this way than it is all the way over on top of itself. So let's guess that it came up this way, which means this stuff is older and this is younger. Anyway, all of this stuff had to get laid down flat, had to get tipped up on end, had to get eroded off to form this surface, and then more sediment, what I assume to be sedimentation. This is either stuff washing off the hills this way and covering this, or it may, I'm thinking that's the case, rather than this being some kind of lava flow that's come down on top of it. And again, we have no, with the collective knowledge of the group here, we have no idea as to what the specific, precise dates of these events are at this point. All we can do is come up with the relative age of the events and write them down on our map. And the way that we then connect this into real time or the geologic time scale is either by knowing something about the fossils that we might find in the beds, or if there were volcanic events that happened and ash fell on it. If the volcano is right next to here, it blows all this stuff out of here and we never see it again, so that's no help. We need a volcano someplace else far away that's far too far to mess this stuff up, but close enough to drop some ash on top of it, and then we can age date the ash. And usually in a situation, you don't have dates on every little piece of information in the pie or in the stack when you stack these things up. Maybe you get two things. Maybe you get one good date off of fossils, and maybe you get one good date off a lava flow or an ash fall. And now there are some things that you can hone in on pretty tightly, and others that just are, well, somewhere between 250 million years ago and 125 million years ago, we don't know, somewhere in there. So that's the last slide I have for today. I finished 2 minutes too early. I'm sorry. Any questions? I don't want to answer questions, those are hard. Tomorrow, let's the hike. If it's like it is today, we're going. If it's raining hard, we're not. And if it's raining hard and you want to go hiking, knock yourself out. I'm staying. if it's like it has been today, if we're gonna get sprinkled on for 5 minutes out of the hour and a half, I'm willing to. If we're gonna get rained on for all 90 minutes, I don't. We got two more days. We'll start talking about the mine tomorrow and hope the weather's better on Thursday. Is there anybody that really wants to go hiking in the rain? Anybody? Okay. All right. So let's meet here. If the weather's good or marginal, we're going. Any questions about what we've covered today?
3 o'clock,
right? 3 o'clock, right? All right. Get out of here.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.